Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So the title of my talk is Form, Function, and Fiction, mostly for alliterative purposes, but I do want to talk about ICTs and their uses in resource-constrained environments. And I am going to do a kitchen sink talk. In other words, I'm going to talk about what my research group, the Design for Digital Inclusion Group, has been working on for the past several years. We've had somewhere between 8 and 12 papers this year that we put out, and a bunch of that is in this talk, so I'm going to encapsulate them, and so there's lots of room for further discussion. Later. So it's an interdisciplinary group. We have graduates and undergraduates in the group, and I also collaborate with faculty across fields. At the end of the talk, I'm going to discuss one particular collaboration that I've done with a colleague in computer science and some of his students. So some of the topics that we deal with in the group range from looking at technology in Central Asia, so that's a longitudinal project that's been funded for several years. There's also something called the Global Impact Study, which is actually run out of the Information School at UW that I'm a participant in, that's looking at the impact of public access to ICTs globally. I do work on non-instrumental uses of technology. One of the PhD students in the group has done some work on technologies for youth with autism. We've looked at games as a component of international development purposes, all kinds of fun stuff. So the questions driving this work essentially come down to what ICTs are adopted in diverse communities and why. And the what there gets very complicated, and that's part of what I want to talk about today. And then once whatever the what is adopted, what do people in these communities do with ICTs? Now, another question associated with that is what kinds of effects are there from ICT use, which I'm not going to talk about today, but it is part of the same general conversation. My goal in asking these questions is to get to the issue of design and think about how can we design better technologies and also policies. Okay, so thinking across community. And the issue of design is kind of one of the primary things that motivates me. So essentially when we name a technology, we give it a kind of label. Okay, and that label comes to represent functions as well as forms. And when we ascribe these labels, we have some kinds of assumptions that technological artifacts have consistent meanings across various social contexts. And actually, that's not so true. There's a whole lot of slippage that happens. And so some functions may, or some of the forms may seem to remain stable, but the functions themselves vary pretty widely. Okay, so from a theoretical perspective, a lot of what underlies this is kind of valuing discourse at the margins, trying to bring it into the center, valuing diversity. And you'll notice that up until this point, I've been using the word diversity rather than the phrase resource-constrained environment, which is in the title, and I'll get to that in just one second. But in terms of studying diversity, you can look across disciplines, and it's actually really interesting, whether people are talking about in genetics or in the environment, issues related to globalization, manufacturing, media conglomeration, management studies, et cetera. There's a ton of work that talks about why diversity is important in all kinds of ways. That what diversity does is it lends a robustness to all kinds of environments. And that in fact, when you don't have diversity, you have systems that are actually pretty brittle, right? They're quite fragile. So part of the goal in this research is to understand the importance of diverse communities being part of the conversation, that this can contribute to more creative approaches to hardware, software, and services design. So on the design side of things, there's all kinds of discourses about design, user-centered design, and value-sensitive design, learner-centered design, appropriate technology, participatory design, each of which is a school of thought with tremendous amounts of overlap with one another, whether or not they acknowledge that. And what our group is trying to do, we're not trying to bifurcate that even further, but what we're trying to do is contribute to how people think about design methods, processes, and sort of incorporating more varied perspectives about usage and function, thinking about design. So I'm going to use this form and function dichotomy. And part of this is really about vocabulary and academic discipline. So I currently teach in engineering. My training is in the humanities. And electrical engineers, when they talk about the internet, they think about it in a very different way than people in the humanities talk about the internet. And so they may actually use the same kinds of definitions, but the certainty with which they use those definitions, there's a gap there, let's just say that. So how do we have a conversation that brings in electrical engineers and computer scientists, that talks about bits, that talks about what happens when you solder something onto a board, but also having a conversation about similar kinds of technologies that bring in humanities and social science scholars that emphasizes the social meaning of those technologies. So that's part of what our group is designed to do, is to bring together those different discourses and produce research that's useful across communities. So I'm going to use these, the form and function, as definitional categories, not as analytical categories per se. And my sort of caveat here is, of course, all of this is grounded in STS work, and read any Beaker or Winner, any technological form, of course, social meaning is embedded in technological form and the way technologies are constructed. Sort of lay that out there on the table. And what's gonna happen as this talk goes on is those boundaries between form and function are gonna blur, and eventually they're gonna collapse. So just get ready.
What's STS?
Science, Technology, Studies.
Thank you.
Society, yes. Okay, so resource constraint, which is the phrase that I have in the title of the talk. I wanna talk about that a little bit. So for many years, I've done work in this area of ICT4D, which stands for Information Communication Technologies and Development. And it is a growing field. And it is essentially, so what my own work in this area has focused on what ICTs look like in developing countries. But the findings from this research community, not just my own work, but if you go to the conferences or read the journals, the findings from the work, they're actually quite relevant for all kinds of communities. But if you sit down and you start having a conversation with someone who looks at developed context, and you say, oh, I study the developing world, what I've noticed is people tend to get a little sleepy. In other words, they just don't necessarily see it as related to the kind of work that they do. So many of us in the community have started tossing around different terms and how might we reframe what we're doing. But it is again one of those definitional issues where the more that my students and I have started to process our data and think about the consequences of some of our research findings, what we found is that geography is the least interesting category to actually think about. That this notion of resource constraint is not about geography, and it's also not static. It's incredibly dynamic. So the availability of resources that you have can change, or does change, and it can change either over short times, like over the period of a day, but it can also change over long periods of time, so a week, a month, a year. And as an example, the transportation research that I'm going to talk about at the end of this presentation came out of research done in Central Asia. The technology design approach, as well as the technology that was created, all embedded in research findings that came out of Central Asia. But the approach, or the technology itself, is also applicable to other kinds of environments, and our next version of the project is working in the Yakima Valley in Washington State. So some of the issues involved in how people incorporate technology into their everyday life transcend those kinds of boundaries. So in some ways, it's also being able to draw different kinds of lines across boundaries. And when I talk about resources, it's a really broad definition. So there's a list of them somewhere, there's a list of some of them up there. So you can talk about economic resources, educational time, how much time do you have, cultural capital, how much bandwidth do you have at your disposal, adaptive technology, what kinds of sensory perception, are haptics gonna work, screen size, devices that you have, so all kinds of restraints. So there's kind of a matrix there, overlay. So what we do is we look at all these sort of splits of resource constraint. Think about it as a dynamic rather than a static state, and then think, well, how are we going to design to accommodate this complexity? Okay, so now I'm going to talk about form, which is the category that will break down fastest. And I want to talk about three things when it comes to the forms of technologies. The first is the internet as a weather-dependent technology, and the emphasis there is on issues of constancy and ubiquity. Then I'm going to talk about the internet as a shared or public resource, and then mobile phones as a bank. And a lot of this, when it comes to function, I'll talk about the internet as a strengthener of social ties, mobile phone as a purveyor of fraud, SMS as a weapon, and games as a source of technological training. So here are some of the methods associated with the Central Asia pieces of the research. And there are other research projects that I mentioned briefly in here that are not Central Asia. I don't have a method slide for everything. I'm happy to talk about it in further detail later. But so the Central Asia component of this has quantitative work and qualitative work associated with it. The quantitative work is a survey that we've done yearly, 06, 07, 08. We do it in four countries, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. 1,000 in each country between the ages of 15 and 65. We've ended up contracting with a firm based in Kazakhstan to oversee the surveys, and that's in part because of So that's in part because of changes in geopolitics and the reputation of the U.S. and U.S. researchers in certain parts of the world. So we changed some of our methods in terms of how the survey was being administered to protect the researchers. So it's a social survey with a tech use module. It's not actually a tech use survey, because internet use in the region is, I think now it's up to about a whopping 11%. I mean, it's pretty low. So you're not going to get much representative information. And so we want to know all kinds of things like issues of trust and confidence in media and different public institutions, people's use of social network, all kinds of stuff. So there's, it's this big survey with all about over 300 variables, and then one piece of it is a tech use module. And there's info up there on the sampling. And then there's the qualitative stuff, which has a bunch of ethnography going back to 2000. Then we've done multiple interview studies with different populations. I'm going to talk about the business people, the interviews with business people, I think, in the context of this talk. Done some usability tests of stuff we've developed, design ethnography, and then observations of public access centers. So that's most of what we've done. Okay, so in terms of form, internet as a weather-dependent technology. I would also say, by the way, if you have questions, feel free to interrupt. So, the open session rather than open season. Yes, sir?
I had a question about the methods on the previous section and how that affected gender splits across the age group that you studied, because I would imagine there might be some differences in gender across the internet usage you observed.
So we do a proportional sampling, so we use the demographics for each country and sample based on that. So we have our sample represents the gender split in the country. It's sort of interesting in that, and I don't have all the numbers memorized, but I know that in Kyrgyzstan, the numbers of internet users, there are more women internet users than men, more female than male. And then some of the gender split follows what you would expect in terms of the traditionalism of the four countries as well, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, I think, being most representative there. And I also say this work is all funded by the National Science Foundation, which means that it's free to the public. So if you want a data set, let me know.
I should, we're supposed to be using the microphone. It's a new innovation. Apparently, the webcast sound is not very good. So sorry, I'll need to pass this down to the next person.
Ceiling cat died.
Ceiling cat died a long time ago. Okay, so the internet is a weather-dependent technology. So we're going to go to Cambodia for this one. Actually, this is in Central Asia. Rainy season in Phnom Penh, and we get on a plane, and we're going to fly up to Ratnakiri, which is up in the northern part near the border of Laos. It's very pretty. We're going to take a little moto down the main street, and we're going to go to the public access center in the town, the one place where you can get internet access. I don't have a lolcat photo, which I know is a failing, but there is a cat at least. But this cat's actually very important because his job is to eat the rats that come in and chew through the library there. So that's the public library in the center and in the city. So I show up and I'm there to do some interviews of internet users, and there's no one there. And I said, you told me to come at whatever, and there's no one here. And the person who ran the center said, oh, it just rained. And I said, it's rainy season in Cambodia. It rains every day. Why would that keep people from coming? He said, well, when it rains, the internet goes down. And said, well, we have this generator, so they fire up their generator in the back so they can get the computers back up and running fairly quickly. But the people in town who maintain the internet access, it takes them about an hour to 2 hours to get things up and running with the internet connection. And people in town know that. So after a hard rain, they don't show up for a couple hours. And he said, just wait a couple hours and the center will be full. And sure enough, I went off, came back 2 hours later, and the center is full of people there to use it. Yeah.
Depending on satellites for their internet access, and the rain gets in the way. Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I sort of enjoy about this story is the way that it complicates for me this notion of what is the internet, and is it a ubiquitous technology? And so in computer science and HCI, there's a conference called Ubicomp, Ubiquitous Computing, which is all about designing devices and applications to help with the sort of always connected characteristics of our life. But actually, the internet is not necessarily a ubiquitous technology, and it is also not necessarily constant. So often I'll ask my students, and I guess I could ask this room here, how many of you know where the yellow pages are in your house? Okay, so that's like a third. And so among my peer group, people, the yellow pages show up, and they throw in the recycling bin, try to figure out how do I get off the list to get yet another delivery of this useless paper object, because anytime I need to know where something is, I can go online and I can look it up. So we have grown accustomed, just really quite habituated to this idea that it's always available. Interestingly enough, whenever I talk to people who live in less urban areas of the US, their response pattern is different, right? They're used to more intermittent availability of the technology. And so that's actually one of the connections between, say, Central Asia and rural areas of Washington. Okay, so how often do you use the internet? How often do you all use the internet?
Yeah.
Is it going to look like that? Right. So the question of what is the internet dovetails with what is the internet, what is an internet user? Okay, what does it mean to be an internet user? So the ITU compiles all these statistics and numbers of internet users, and I find them really fascinating, and then I want to know more about how they're defining an internet user. So often an internet user is anyone who says that they've touched the internet, which is, if you want to talk about the social meaning of the technology or its cultural meanings or its potential transformative effects, it's very, those definitions are really crucial to understand. So this is based again on the Central Asia data. So people who go online several times a day, that's at 13%, which is roughly the same as people who go online every few weeks, which is at 14%. So it's a very different pattern in terms of how people are incorporating it into their everyday lives and what they're doing with the technology. So it's not ubiquitous, it turns out. and then when people do go online, this is about how much time they're spending online. This is the last time. So half hour less, 30 minutes to less, and then about an hour. So only 15% of the people said that they spend more than one, less than 2 hours. And then going up from there, the numbers get really small. So 4 more hours is 3%.
Where is this from?
This is from Central Asia. So this is Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan. You know, roughly $1 an hour if you're at a public access center. I mean, there's some variation, but roughly $1 an hour.
Local, how much is $1 an hour?
Monthly income varies from country to country, but maybe $100 a month.
Does the beer rule work for Central Asia?
It does.
Okay.
$1 an hour. $1 a beer.
It basically, if you want to run a successful internet cafe, you should price cyber cafe time at 1 hour of cyber cafe time costs what a beer costs over the counter.
Depends on whether the beer is Russian or not. Sorry?
Less so than you.
Well, I was just thinking about the pricing structure. Was there another question? Okay. So about how much time did you spend online? Again, going back to this notion of ubiquity, and I would ask you to remember what I said at the beginning, that what I'm trying to do is have a conversation that's meaningful to engineers as well as to social scientists and humanities folks, and highlight the complexity of some of these issues. Okay, so what is the internet? What is an internet user? And then this question of the internet as a shared public resource rather than a personal technology. Okay, so I have a cell phone, it's a personal technology. I can access the internet on my cell phone, so I have mobile internet on my personal technology device. Not necessarily a use scenario that's gonna hold. If I go to a public access center, there's your pricing there, Ethan. One somani to play a game, one somani to be online, but it's 2.5 somanis to use the internet. So, chat. Online is chat. Internet is anytime you're downloading a web page and it's kilobytes or megabytes, then it's a different pricing structure, which also affects what people do with the resource when it's more expensive to download. It's like some of the conversations that are going on in the US now about with sort of net neutrality and Comcast doing the Metering.
Throttling.
Sorry?
Bandwidth throttling.
Yes. Well, bandwidth throttling is one part, but the other part is charging you based on how much you download. And most people don't have a sense of when they go to a web page, how many kilobytes that actually is, or megabytes. And so the kind of chilling effect of that. Okay, so where do you use the internet most often? This is from 2008, this data here, and we have seen some change from 06 to 08 in terms of the increase in use, particularly at work and school, but this is regional across the four countries. I can't really accommodate for the really large don't know, refused answer. What I can say is this question is paired with another one that says, where are all the places that you use the internet? And then we ask, where do you use it most often? So I think maybe some people just kind of get caught in the, well, I use it the same amount at school and at home, so I don't know how to answer. the broadband, there's some DSL in the capital cities. That would be about it. A lot of people are still using dial-up, particularly in the regions. The increase at school in particular has been something that's pretty interesting to note. If you break down the four countries, you'll find different patterns, particularly Kazakhstan is kind of the standout. They're sort of the different of the four in terms of the rate of growth and the numbers of users and the ease with which one can get home internet access. Okay, so where are you using it most often? Again, just trying to understand what is the internet, how does it function in people's everyday lives? So what these next four diagrams are is looking at those public sites where people get access and what are the kind of suite of activities. So going back to this, and if I think about, because I'm fascinated with transportation these days, an analogy I can come up with is riding a bus versus driving my car. When I ride the bus, I'm taking public transportation, and the suite of activities that I'm going to engage in is going to be different than when I'm driving in my own car, even though I'm ultimately getting to the same place. So if I'm on the bus in Almaty, I'm on the bus of internet usage, what are the things that are going on around me that I would have access to? So this is just a kind of overview for you of some of the entertainment-based activities, some of the business kinds of things like printing or faxing, photocopying, voice over IP. The voice over IP, which is the green bubble to the right there, is the one that varies the most, actually. So come on over to Tashkent, tiny, 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 and Dushanbe, pretty big, Bishkek, huge, and this is all about policy. So if you track the way that VoIP has been regulated in the four countries, that's completely congruent with those findings there. Okay, so the third is about mobile phones, internet alphabet, internet, and internet users. A definitional thing about what is a mobile phone as a technical device. So we all know that one of the reasons mobile phone adoption is so high is because telecom infrastructure can look like this. So they are these replacement devices. And so one of the really fast growing areas for mobile services in developing countries has been banking services. So this is a alert message from using M-Pesa, okay, which is in Kenya. And then there's GCash and, yes?
It looks like to use this technology, you need to know English. Wouldn't that screen out a large amount of the population from using this service?
So I'm gonna talk about that actually when I get to the games component of this, but there's actually, in this region, I mean, there's a fair amount of content online in Russian. So, I mean, there's not as much in local languages, but there's a fair amount in Russian. It's pretty bilingual region.
I was responding to the screen that you're showing.
Oh, this is from Kenya. This is in Kenya.
Oh,
this is the English version of it. There's a full
Kiswahili
version
and a
couple of other versions.
No. This is what I saw because I wanted it in English. Okay. So the mobile phone, which was not created as a banking device and is increasingly becoming a money transfer device for many, many people, super interesting. All kinds of implications in terms of design and how you want to design it to be a more secure device. I am consistently shocked with how many people who are not using their phones for banking but are using them for internet do things like don't have passwords on them. If you lose your phone and someone has access to your phone and then they have all your email and maybe your Facebook account and your Twitter and everything else. So just little things like that feed into design and how important are design elements. So from a UI perspective, how transparent is the password protection on your phone? How obvious is it to you that that is a good thing for you to do? Okay, so now I'm gonna go to function. Well, let me just briefly mention one other thing, just because I know that with the Digital Natives Project here that there's a lot of interest in youth and technology and sort of the importance of the internet to youth. So one of the studies that we did in this past March was we tried to understand internet non-use, and so we did an interview study. And it, when people talk to folks who don't use the internet about why they don't use the internet, usually you get, it's too expensive, I don't know how to use it, there's nothing there that's interesting to me. That's sort of the triad of responses that you get most often. But we wanted to drill a little bit more deeply and understand non-use. So we actually talked to internet users who have people in their social network who don't use it to try to understand why they haven't tried to convert their friends and family into using it. And one of the themes that emerged from that interview study, which was sort of interesting, was this notion that the internet is for youth, that it's for young people, not for old people. But if when you look at our transcripts, the definition of youth is basically whatever your age is, that you are young, and anyone who's older than you is old. So regardless of what the age was of our respondents, whether they were in their 20s or they were in their 40s, it was, the internet is for me, but it's not for old people. So. Okay, it's not really about bits, but I thought it was a good anecdote. So function, ICTs is a strengthener of a social network. I'm gonna talk about mobiles and fraud, SMS, just to honor the day, and then games as a kind of technical training. So this stuff is pulled from a paper, I guess as I've been going through, I could have sort of talked about the different papers associated with some of these findings, but oh well. So this represents some of the results of our design ethnography from a couple years ago now, but it relates the exchange of goods and information via social network from the respondents, from the participants in the design ethnography. And what we're trying to do is see how things flowed through the network, but also gauge the reciprocity. And so that's where the sort of back and forth of the arrows give you a sense of where things are most reciprocal within the social network. So one of the things we wanted to do, and so Cynthia Putnam, who's a PhD student in the group, does the mad stats. And so she did a logistic regression on this. And she looked at the demographic variables and controlled for them, said, okay, one of the things that we know is demographics influence a lot about who chooses to use technology. So let's go ahead and control for those. Let's get them off the table and see whether people who use the social network more are going to be more or less likely to use technology. Sort of, is technology an individuating force or not? And lo and behold, one of the things that she found, or that we found, is that some of the variables that measure social network use and trust actually do predict a small but significant variation in technology use. So take demographics off the table, people who use their social networks are more likely to use technology. And
here we mean conventional social networks, not
face-to-face. Correct, we mean face-to-face. We were talking only face-to-face social networks. And thank you for that. So there's a bunch of other findings in this paper. I guess this is one of those things that I can sort of direct you to later, but we broke people into three categories. So there were non-users, low users, and high users. Okay, so it was kind of a rough division of the respondents. This is from the survey data. And then we said, okay, who uses the social network and what's their level of trust in that social network? Well, those were the two things that we wanted to get. So how often do you use it, and then how much do you trust it? Because just because you use it doesn't mean you trust it. And we, of course, were responding to the kind of body of literature, including some of the moral panic about the use of technology makes social networks more brittle and fragments them, and then people go online and get depressed or things like that. So going way back to that initial problematic Carnegie Mellon piece. And so what we found in Central Asia is that the people who get online and use the technology actually report increased use of their face-to-face social networks and increased levels of trust in friends and family, not in neighbors, but with friends and family. And one of the other things that we did, we said, well, maybe these people are just sort of, they're information omnivores. They are just the kind of people who go out and seek more information. And so we ran another analysis on the data to control for that. So it turns out that's not actually the explanation. Okay, so you've got people using the social network and using technology, and it's great because one does not have a negative effect on the other. That's one of our nice findings. This is just kind of an overview of, do you do any of these things online? And one of the other students is working on sort of taking these findings and comparing it to survey work being done in other parts of the world, either from Pew or from other international studies as well. Sort of, what do people do when they get online? And so as one might expect in a country that essentially doesn't have credit cards and has very little of a formal banking structure, there's not a whole lot of online banking or online shopping going on, not a lot of participating in online auctions either. There's actually not that much webcam chat. I was surprised by that, particularly given the diaspora and the ways in which people use the internet to keep in touch with friends and family. And when you go to internet cafes, the webcams are pretty ubiquitous. We could actually go back to those bubbles. So they do a lot of research for school or job training, looking for information. They look for scholarships, downloading music and some video, and then browsing the internet for fun as well, and a fair amount of IM. So IM in chat rooms, cheaper than using the internet, sort of going back to, at least in some countries, not all. So, all right, so this is just sort of a general overview of some internet use, okay, and that it's not necessarily something that's going to weaken the social network. Okay, so now we're gonna talk about mobiles and fraud, and I completely acknowledge that's an inflammatory title, but there you go. So we have all these narratives about why people use mobile phones and how often they use them. So this is again from the Central Asia data, very different from the internet. So they're using phones much more often than they're using the internet, which is one of the patterns that's really key. And there's no mobile internet. I'm gonna just say, there's like 2% people who use mobile internet. The service is available, people don't use it. So what do you do on your mobile phone? So take pictures, download, play music. Do I connect to the internet? There it is, tiny. I do play games, I send some SMS, I look for information, and I make personal calls. Essentially, that's what I do. I make personal calls and some calls from work, and then I text. We also wanted to get at what motivated people to get a mobile phone, because there's the whole discourse about the replacement, that is the replacement for the lacking landline, which actually didn't come up very often in terms of people's responses. There are a lot of people who say they have no home phone, but not necessarily that it's too long to have it installed or that it's cheaper. They want to be reached. They want to be able to make calls when they're not home, and they want to be reachable. So those are all some of the delightful things about mobiles and why people love them and why they adopt them. And so we can construct a definition of a mobile user, and we have done that in some of our work. And we have these great personas for design perspectives on who uses mobiles. And then this screenshot is also from Kenya, and it's, oh my goodness, I'm completely spacing. It's the Nigerian, is it 419? So this is an example of essentially the 419 scam that I received as a text message, which I thought was awesome. And I called the phone number and had a long conversation with the person on the other side, on the other end. And so at the end of the conversation, he said, okay, I need you to give me your passport number. Do you understand? And I said, oh, yes, yes, I understand. And so then I hung up. But the... So yeah, I had made up a number already to apply for my Safaricom account. So, and actually the number was not even in Kenya, the callback number, which I didn't even notice at first. So anyway, all I'm trying to say is that what we use mobiles for is complex, and it's not all the ways in which the narratives follow. And then there's SMS as a weapon. And of course, so here's all I really want to do is talk about Iran, but here we are, and I don't study Iran, so I can't talk about it, but I can put up a picture. So what I want to talk about is sort of the role of SMS in revolution, and the kind of fragmenting of information dissemination networks, and the pros and cons of that. So there are two small qualitative studies that I've done, one in Kyrgyzstan in 05 after the Tulip Revolution, and one in Kenya in 08, shortly after the election violence there, that did some interviews about how people used SMS during those events. And so one of the things that emerged in the Kyrgyzstan study was that SMS was used not so much in terms of rallying people in advance of the march into the capital and the overthrow of the presidential palace, which is called the White House, but that people did report increased use of SMS in the aftermath. So there was a lot of rioting, a lot of looting afterwards, and the people who participated in the study reported that SMS was used to warn people to stay home, but then ultimately to call out friends and family to help defend businesses that were owned by friends and family. And then there were also reports that the looters were using SMS in order to identify targets and converge on them. But those are allegations. I don't have any direct evidence of that. The study that we did in Kenya, the interview study that we did there, one of the things that emerged was the way in which SMS was used to disseminate hate speech and disinformation, whether purposeful or accidental. And so there were a couple cases of narratives going viral among communities that started spreading via SMS that took stories that were I guess it's the best kind of rumor, right? Or the best kind of disinformation. It takes maybe 75% truth and then changes about the 25%. And so it's just plausible enough to be believable and just inflammatory enough to be dangerous in terms of motivating violence. Okay, the fourth thing in terms of some of the functions of technology in resource-constrained environments, games is tech training. And so these are places, again, where there's not going to be, the resource here is, the resource constraint is about education. I don't have a lot of availability, say, for learning about computers, learning to use computers. One of the functions of games in these environments is that they provide, for many people, the potential first touch of ICT, okay? So when ICT becomes available in a community, and you saw this in the pricing photo that I had earlier, playing games is cheaper than accessing the internet. I'm talking about standalone games here, or land-based games, not internet-based games. So it's cheaper than using the internet. So if I don't have a lot of money, what am I going to do? And yet there's this kind of aspirational modernity attractive force of technology. I find this very interesting. I don't have it at my school. I'm a young person, and what am I going to do? I'm more likely to play games than use the internet, both in terms of how easy it is to gain some skill, and then also what resources I have available to me. So there's these great, and this is from a paper that was published at a conference in March, but essentially you can look at the history of public access internet sites, and you can see the ways in which in the early stages, before there were very many internet users, the people who would occupy them were playing games. Very few people were using the internet. So here's this business, it's open, there's 15, 20 computers, they are connected to the internet, and most of the people who come through the door are sitting down to play games. But that means that when the one person who comes through the door who does want to use the internet comes in, that business is available in the community. So that resource is available to the person, it's sustained through the playing of games. But the people gain their first, the kids are gaining their first exposure to ICTs by sitting down playing games because it's cheaper. And it's also, it's more ubiquitous in that there are these separate game cafes from internet cafes, and that's a whole other narrative. But one of the other things that games do is they provide an alternate pathway to ICT training. So a little bit earlier, someone asked a question about English language ability. So we did some statistical work on our survey findings to sort of separate out the internet user population from the gaming population, people who play games but don't use the internet. And one of the things that we found is that people who play games but don't use the internet have less education and less knowledge, fewer years of education and less knowledge of English. Okay, so it's actually a different population that's able to get a pathway of exposure to using ICTs. So
games, games.
Both. Yep. So you can check out games there. It's also things like solitaire. I mean, it's the whole gamut. And then they scroll down some of the stats for the game players. Some of the numbers are pretty, you know, about 64% urban versus 36% rural, 63% men, 37% women who say they play games. The mean is 27 years old, which is pretty interesting. But that's also potentially because our survey only goes down to age 15, and there's a huge youth bubble in Central Asia. So, but we couldn't go any younger than 15. So that's sort of, in terms of thinking about what are some of the uses, some of the functions to which that ICTs serve in developing regions or resource-constrained environments, games actually can teach people how to use computers. Okay, so that's from understanding, that sort of lays the foundation for how do we start to understand and ask these questions to drill down and get really fine-grained definitions of these characteristics of ICTs. And then I want to go to building, because I care about design and I care about making stuff. So one of the things that we did a couple years ago was we conducted a design ethnography we use that to then feed into some modified design methods, which then fed into prototype development, and that the TBD stands for to be deployed, not to be determined.
Can you explain what a design ethnography
is? I can. A design ethnography uses some of the characteristics of ethnographic method, but has its focus on the idea of product design or some kind of technology design. So you work with people, and I'll show you some photos of some of the activities that we engaged in. The folks from Intel, Genevieve Bell and Tony Salvador, have written about design ethnography. And there's a conference called EPIC, and I'm not going to remember what the acronym stands for right now, but that folks who spend their time, their fieldwork time, going in and talking to people, not necessarily about, say, ritual or kinship, but about how they integrate devices or other kinds of physical artifacts into their everyday life, and thinking about how to either problem solve with new technology or scaffold existing solutions. Okay, so we went and did a design ethnography that was focused on three things. We wanted to understand people's use, particularly of mobiles. And this is because after several years of work in the region, what we noticed is that mobile technology adoption was going like this, and internet adoption was going kind of like this. So we thought, well, it's probably more useful at this point to think about mobile adoption, designing for the mobile platform. So we wanted to look at mobiles, we wanted to look at people's social networks, and we also wanted to, their use of social networks, and we wanted to look at pain points of everyday life. Okay, and the idea was sort of bring findings about those three things together to think about some design approaches. And this design ethnography was led by another PhD student in the group, Emma Rose. Attribution is important. So here we are conducting some of our design ethnography. So one of the things we did was go into people's homes. We worked with two different kinds of groups, one with a family, an intergenerational family, and the other a group of young people who had familiarity with each other already. And we did it in urban and rural locations. So we did individual interviews with each person, and then we did a group interview with each of our folks, and then we had them draw social network diagrams. And this one's in English, so it's a good one to show. And so we had them talk not just who they interact with, but where they interact with them and any technologies they use to interact with those people. So this person actually drew a really great key in the corner. So here's another one. That's sort of what most of them look like. So we have them sort of work on this to lay out for us the first two components of what we were talking about. And then in the interview studies, that's when we really worked on the questions of pain points of everyday life. So we went through all of this, collected a bunch of data, really amazed at the personal, the sort of the resonance of the personal technology in people's everyday lives. And then from all of that data, we decided, okay, there's two designs that we want to explore. And the first was looking at mobile social software ideas to come up with some kind of directory, and the other was the transportation project. So the Mososo directory was designed to address a lack of published information directories. There are information phone lines, but they're oversubscribed, they're hard to get through, or they're expensive. Also, we were leveraging people's reliance on family and friends for recommendations, and then acknowledging that they have SMS usage, but almost zero usage of mobile internet. In other words, we didn't want to design a mobile internet solution, and we didn't want to design an internet solution either, because most people are logging on once or twice a week. So the Starbus is a project about public transportation, which is mostly ad hoc and shared. There's little information available about routes or timing. Again, we know people are using their mobiles. Phones don't have GPS. They're not likely to have GPS anytime soon. And if you want an information infrastructure, build it from the ground up, because there's no central authority that's going to provide that public service out of the goodness of their hearts. So one of the design pieces that we worked on in the group was this notion of personas, which is a approach in user-centered design that some people really love and some people really hate. But what we did was we tried to adapt it, and this is again work by Cynthia Putnam, tried to adapt the notion of personas by using pre-existing information, acknowledging definitional messiness in terms of that, who is an internet user, what is the internet, who is a mobile phone user, why do people use the internet, and accommodating that kind of divergence of form and function, and also thinking recursively about users, technology, thinking about users, researching users, developing a technology in response to that information, and then going back to the user. So that kind of recursive design approach. So these are some of the personas that she developed based on our information. And again, this is one of those other cases where I'm gonna say, forward you to the article, because I have my eye on the clock and I want to make sure that we have time for questions. So what she did was she took the results from the design ethnography, the different kinds of activities that we did as a result of that study, which was interviews, observations, focus groups, and then having people fill out some checklists and also do those diagrams, and sort of compiling a persona which is grounded in real information, that but speaks to a more generalized version that can be used to think about design usefully. So we have those three. The mobile directory is the first thing that Cynthia designed, and this is a mock-up of it. We use this for usability testing in the region. And essentially what it is, it's a combination of TripAdvisor and Angie's List and Amazon.com recommendations and eBay reputation, but all available via SMS. So essentially you list businesses and then you rate them. And so there's a public directory, and the respondents, almost all of them said, well, why would I trust this? And so then we explained, well, there's this main shared directory, but then there's also another directory that you establish with your friends and family that's password protected. So your friends and family can rate things, and then you can access the ratings. Seems really simple in an information poor environment. It can be incredibly useful. The second one is the Starbus project. I think some of you have heard me talk about this before. I love this project. In part because I am completely fascinated by infrastructure these days, and actually the New York Times gave me a great visual aid on Sunday. Can't wait to read this. The Sunday magazine has the cover story is infrastructure, so that's my reading tonight. So I use the bus in the city that I live in, and there are all kinds of great tools for me to find out what route to take and when the next bus is going to come, and it's fantastic. Make taking public transportation really pretty easy. In most of the developing world, you have ad hoc shared transportation. This is actually a really structured site to go to for intercity transportation. You go to a bus depot and the location, the destination is listed up above there, and you're going to get on the bus, but the bus doesn't go until it's full. And if you're going to a popular destination, it might fill up in, you know, like half an hour. That's not so bad. But if you're going somewhere off season or somewhere that's not necessarily a popular destination, you can wait hours before the bus goes. So it's not necessarily the most time efficient way of getting from point A to point B. So what we wanted to do was just, how can you make this a little bit more efficient for people? And then for intra-city transportation, a lot of our respondents talked about, and this is again from the design ethnography, our respondents talked about some of the difficulties with waiting for these little buses are called mashrutka, waiting for a mashrutka at night. It's not safe to be on the street after dark, or maybe it's too cold, or all sorts of reasons why you wouldn't want to wait indefinitely. And so traffic is just, you know, traffic's a big problem. Getting from point A to point B is a problem. So I worked with a colleague of mine in computer science, and his students built a system called a Starbucks, which has a GPS in it. And you put this on a little bus, and the GPS receiver has GPS and a GSM modem, and then they built some code for a server. And what happens is the bus is driving, and Starbucks says, here I am. Oh, now I'm over here. Okay, now I'm over here. So it sends SMS messages saying where it's going. Oh, there's a diagram. And that goes to the server. If I'm a user, and we preceded the system with a bunch of landmarks, I'm standing in front of the State Department store, I send an SMS to the server and I say, okay, I'm standing in front of the State Department store, I'm waiting for bus 31, when will it be here? And it will say, it will be there at 1:45. And I say, great, I'll go out and get it. And so the way that we did this was, you have the Starbucks run around a bunch of places, and then you have a traffic algorithm, and it calculates sort of when it sends the message to the server estimates when it's going to get to the next landmark. So all of this stuff, so when we tested this over there, and this is going back to the form question, it worked seamlessly in Seattle. So then in March, we went to Bishkek to test it. And it was not until the last day that the Starbucks would work. And it took us forever to figure out why the Starbucks wasn't working. And it turned out the reason it wasn't working was because the cell towers in Bishkek required more power from the GSM modem than the cell towers in Seattle. And so we had to completely take it apart and resolder it with a new power solution. And what we'd done was we had made it as low power as possible to maximize the battery, right? A classic design approach in an ICTD context that failed miserably. So this is just more sort of technology stuff. So the Starbucks sits on the Starbus, and we did usability testing and technical testing in March. And the reaction to the folks with whom we did the usability testing was they were very excited. They said, when can I use this? When can I use this? So it's not deployed, and what I will sort of use this platform of, I am continuing to look for anyone who has a transportation problem they think needs to be solved somewhere in the world, and we want to try to deploy this and solve a problem somewhere, see if it works, see if it actually does what we think it's going to do. So...
Have you talked to Brookline?
No, but but maybe I should?
Yes.
Okay.
You can easily wait an hour for a bus.
So they're not instrumented already? The buses aren't instrumented?
No.
So the thing is, in Seattle, the bus is already instrumented for Metro's purpose, and they made all of that public. So people have written little SMS apps for free on top of it, which is great. But the buses, like, I would be, well, okay, that would be interesting to know whether or not those buses are instrumented already, and then you can repurpose that information. But
they're not, which is actually part of the fascination. In the recent case last week, that you would have enjoyed if somebody stood off of the bus making a phone call, because they're not allowed to use the phones on
the driver.
The driver. Yeah. So it just waited for an extra 20 minutes as he made a phone call.
Huh.
And got YouTubed.
Got YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And fired.
Okay. Anyway. Okay. Right. Focus. So the point I want to make about Mososo and Starbus is that both of those, and I didn't talk in detail about the design process and how that links back to sort of asking those finely detailed questions, but some of the links should be pretty obvious in terms of drilling down into what is an internet user. And so we have this big bucket of internet users in the region, but once you start asking, okay, what does it mean to be an internet user? Oh, you mean you use it once or twice a week? Oh, and then when you're online, you're usually using it for 15 minutes, and a full 30% of you use it at public access centers, or 6% of you use it at work. So what kind of ubiquity is there to this technology, and how can we actually start designing things that make sense in this context? That's the kind of connection that we're trying to make as we kind of bring together these disciplines. And I want to give a big thank you to the folks, the members of my lab, current members up there, Cynthia Putnam, Rebecca Walton, Chad Drusbeck, Ellie Searle, Mark Stewart, Emma Rose, and Erica Johnson. And they are all various co-authors on different of these papers. And then the Starbus project, which was in conjunction with Gaetano Borriello, Ruth Anderson, Katie Lustig, Anthony Poon, and Waylon Brunette, who were fabulous to work with, and also thanks to NSF. So that's sort of my quick tour of ICT in the developing world and how people use it. And David's phone is ringing. But does anyone have any questions? Thank you. Yeah.
So at what point does pornography and gambling enter into computer usage in developing countries?
So I haven't noticed that gambling is a big thing, and I think part of that is the banking issue, that transferring, people don't necessarily have bank accounts, so I think that actually transferring money is pretty challenging. Pornography is, in many public access sites, is banned outright, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. So if you go in, and this is one of the things that I've done on occasion, go in and look at the drop down, you know, the history. And there's plenty of porn that people are surfing, even when the signs say you can't look at porn, that you'll be fined massively. So, but I think the general argument is that is pornography has driven every major technical innovation in this area, so it's kind of part of the narrative. No other questions?
Does the microphone scare you off?
Do you have any thoughts about why people who use the internet report these higher levels of trust? I mean, that seemed like an interesting point.
It is an interesting point. I don't know why. People have higher trust to use the internet? Well, so we're only talking about correlation. We are not talking about causality. Yeah. What we were looking at was whether there was a decrease in trust among, so whether you could separate out those two populations and show a decrease in trust among people who use the technology. I think, so for information resources, there's a discrepancy between the frequency with which people use sources and the trust that they have in those sources. So that's always been one of the interesting things for me about that region, and then trying to drill down into that. But so I don't know if that would have any relationship or not.
This is...
Wow, none of the table mics work, huh?
Is there a direct correlation between quality of life and internet use?
How do you define quality of life?
Well, there's lots of people who, I mean, who use different metrics based on education, health, and other just general self-reported
patterns. Yeah, that's an analysis we haven't done with the region at all. And I don't know, so that would be interesting. I mean, since you're looking at only about a 10% adoption rate, I don't know what that means for those sorts of conclusions.
That's a lot.
I'd be a bit curious about those public access centers. Are those being set up by government agencies or are those entrepreneuring people?
The entrepreneuring people, they're all commercial, to think for a second. Some of the early ones, so I lived in Uzbekistan in 2000, and in December 2000, there were 13 internet access sites in the city. Tashkent has like 3 million people. And a couple of those were, two of those I think were NGO-based, two or three. But the ones that were part of the qualitative, what we did was we had researchers in each country in various cities go quarterly to an internet access site and do a series of observations. Essentially, that's where that data comes from, and they were all commercial sites. Because that was one of the things for them to report back on, whether it was run by at a school, run by an NGO, or commercial.
Do agencies have any plans to try and set up their own?
I know of none. I know that there is a foundation that has thought of, that is looking at whether it wants to partner with some of the public libraries in one of the countries and make internet access part of the public library offerings. But that is currently underway, and I believe it's Kyrgyzstan is where they're looking.
If I'm a ominous speak, sort of yours.
Great. Well, I'll avoid that awkwardness. If I'm a business person and I want to develop products for commercial purposes, do you have general purpose? I assume that there are not general rules that emerge from this about human behavior, but that's actually a question, I guess. What would you tell me? What is it that I should be doing differently in order to better design products for my markets?
I would avoid sort of general descriptions of populations do X, like this many people use the internet, or one of the questions that I really want to answer now is, and I think the GSMA is probably the organization to ask this, but we have these fabulous figures about the number of mobile subscribers in the world. But I want to know at any given time, what percentage of those mobile subscribers actually have minutes on their phone? How many of them are actually active users of the technology? I'm just a researcher, I'm not an industry professional, so the industry might have that data and it might be closely held, but I think that's actually one of the things that's really important to ask. And it's the same kind of thing of, you're an internet user, what does that actually mean? How often do you go online and what are you actually doing? And does that mean that you're gonna be like David Weinberger and his internet use? Because you're not gonna use the same kinds of solutions. Although you might want the bus solution. But your phone probably has GPS in it, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, so it's still gonna be a different solution. So one of the things about the Starbus is by acknowledging that people don't have GPS in their phones, what it does is it takes that one GPS unit that's on the bus, there's actually one on each bus, and then it makes it into a technical resource that's usable by the whole community, even though there's only a limited number of them. And that's sort of one of the graceful pieces of that design, is it acknowledges the scarcity of that technical resource, but finds a way for the community as a whole to use it.
I was wondering about the longitudinal aspect of the data. I think that's fascinating. I think it was from 2000 to 2009.
Ethnography is from 2000 to 2009.
And in internet time, that's a huge difference. I mean, like, when was the internet introduced in these areas? And has the amount of local content changed over time? And the people, and
would theoretically then also be the people who use the internet, like how much local content is there now actually? And is that a reason why people don't use it as much as you would think?
So there's one of the other studies that we've done is we've done captures of websites from, I think, starting in 03 or 04, which is whenever the bigger piece of this project was funded, of commercial sites, education sites, e-government sites, and I think there's one other domain. And so we've looked at the change over time, and that's a paper that is going to be at APSA in September, looking at the e-government ones. And until, I think it was 07 or 08, the government of Uzbekistan actually said, they said the purpose of the site is to restrict information. I mean, it's awesome they say that right there. So, but the amount of information that's available on those sites is actually pretty limited. And we can see that, and we can see how it changes over time, and that's one of the things that we're trying to measure. Overall, you're not gonna see a lot of growth of, say, online traditional media having an online presence. The websites of educational institutions, universities, still pretty scarce. But there are a lot of chats and forums. So that's another paper that we did, looking at sort of chats and forum sites in the region. And the audience for those is mixed. It's both people in the region as well as part of the diaspora. So local content might be part of the reason why there's slower adoption. I actually think, I think it's because of the whole split between information and communication, and that this notion of an abstract information resource just doesn't resonate with people as much in the same way. So I think that accounts for the slower adoption rate of internet that we see.
One thing not listed as a use at all was blogging. Is that just something people do not do in these regions?
So the question was about blogging, and that I haven't discussed blogging. So people do blog in the region. It's not part of what we study. It's just outside of the scope of what we've done. So I know that there is there's someone who's published a study of blogging in Kyrgyzstan, and I'm looking at Colin, who might be able to remember his name. I'm completely spacing on his name. I think he just published an article in JCMC in the Journal of Computer-Mediated Communication about blogging in Kyrgyzstan.
Chart saying, what are people using the internet for? That wasn't even a sliver on there.
And that's an artifact of when this study started. So we introduced the mobile stuff about halfway through because we saw that growth there.
I was going to say a totally half-formed question, an ill and unformed question on the notion. Yeah, well, I'm going to leave it up to you to make something intelligent or at least interesting out of it. So one was your feeling that they have the notion of an abstract information resource is not kind of resonant or not there. The other is this notion that trust in the social network can potentially play a role in this and be powerful. And then I guess the third thing that I would introduce is something that I've seen is the lack of information literacy and kind of knowing how to kind of new, lack of new media literacy and being able to discern what are good or what the attributes of a particular resource are, and wondering how trust and social networks interact with that, and also how those feed into or are complicated by the concept of an abstract information resource.
So I want to separate
any good things out there and then discard the rest.
Okay. I'm going to separate it into two separate issues and then sort of shunt one aside, because I think the issue of information literacy gets complicated in a post-Soviet context. And that's not something that I am going to discuss right now. But I think that certainly in the work that we've done, people say, oh, well, we learned to read between the lines, that there's a different kind, there's a different way in which people engage in media consumption. And so what might look like media illiteracy might just be a different kind of media literacy. So, I mean, there are people there who've done very interesting things, and this is still being broadcast, right? Okay. Yeah, I'll talk to you about that afterwards. But some people have done very creative things going from digital to mimeograph, literally, like taking online resources, knowing that people in the community don't have online access, printing them out, and essentially making an old-style newsletter and distributing it in rural areas. So it's this kind of counterflow. So that's sort of an interesting version of media literacy, of understanding how media spreads throughout a community and adapting the resources that are available appropriately. The second part of the notion of an information resource or an abstract information resource not being immediately resonant, so that's something that I've been interested in for years, and I think is part of the very beginnings of this project, which is in the sort of Big Bang stage of internet of the internet age, as Lachman said, 2000 was really, really early on. And so I taught university students, and we looked at the internet, and people wanted to know what it was, and I tried to describe it as an online yellow pages, and it just, you know, was a metaphor. And there's this whole kind of school of thought in terms of UI design in the US, and we use these metaphors, and these metaphors are not cross-culturally appropriate. So that's a whole other, that's what I used to write about. That's a whole other kettle of fish. But I'm sort of interested in whether the abstract information resource gap would be as relevant in other developing regions. And so one of my anecdotal approaches to this is when I talk to different groups of people, I say, would you rather give up your mobile phone or would you rather give up the internet? Assuming you can't get the internet on your mobile phone. And looking at the different patterns of responses that I get from people. In that interview study we did in March that I talked about non-users, best answer I think ever from one of our studies, someone said, that's like asking me to choose between my mother and my father. So, but if you go to different communities in the U.S. and you ask that question, it's very interesting what you see and how people respond based on their age, gender, ethnicity, where they live, all kinds of fun demographics.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks so much.